Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Liftoff of the mighty Delta IV Heavy rocket with NASA's Parker Solar Probe. A daring mission to shed light on the mysteries of our closest star, the Sun.
Well, that launch took place almost exactly 3 years ago, in August of 2018. It's a mission that the University of Iowa has a role in. Joining me now, Jasper Halicus. He's associate professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa. He's the lead author of a new study called The Sunward Electron Deficit, a Telltale Sign of the Sun's Electric Potential, published online July 14th in the Astrophysical Journal. Jasper, welcome back to our program.
Thanks, Ben. Always a pleasure to be here.
Before we talk about this new study and your role, these latest findings, remind us what the Parker Solar Probe mission is all about.
Well, it's really it's a first-of-kind mission. We're getting closer to the Sun than anything man-made has ever gone before. So we're going into an environment that we've never been able to sample and touch and taste. And we're doing it with state-of-the-art instruments, the best that have ever been built. And we're trying to understand how the solar wind, this stream of hot ionized plasma that flows out from the Sun throughout our solar system, how that solar wind actually gets accelerated and energized and what makes it go.
Mm-hmm. Where is the probe now?
Right now, we're heading back in for our ninth orbit of the Sun. So we take about 100 days per orbit. We come back out almost to the Earth, about to the orbit of Venus, and then we dive back in another time. And every couple of orbits, we fly right by Venus and dump a little bit of our momentum, slow down a little bit, which allows us to get in closer to the Sun. So it's a very gradual mission. We're gradually easing our way in closer and closer, orbit by orbit.
Mm-hmm. And so when we imagine the orbits here, they're sort of elliptical in shape.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned Venus. So it's like that slingshot. We use gravity of the planets, or perhaps just the Sun, and that accelerates us. And then you say we go by Venus to kind of put the brakes on.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. You might think that it'd be really easy to get close to the Sun because, you know, the Sun has a strong gravity and it's pulling us in there. But actually, it's very hard because we start out with the velocity of the Earth. So it's as if we're starting out at the edge of a merry-go-round and trying to pull our way closer and closer and closer to the middle. And anyone who's ever tried to do that on a fast-moving merry-go-round knows just how hard that is.
Indeed. So let's talk more about your role, the UI's role. What is the instrument you're paying attention to on this probe?
So the instrument that I most closely work with is called the Solar Probe Analyzer for Electrons, or SPAN-E, and that instrument is doing just what it sounds like. It's analyzing the electrons around the Sun.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and the latest findings reveal what?
Well, it's amazing that the closer and closer you get to the Sun, the less kind of bashed up the electrons are. So I always like to use the analogy that looking at the solar wind close to the Earth is like looking at a river miles downstream and trying to understand a waterfall at its source. Now with Parker Solar Probe, we're actually getting right up to the bottom of that waterfall and looking at the processes that accelerate the solar wind. And when we get that far upstream, we can actually read information in the electrons that is no longer there by the time they get all the way out to the Earth.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about what electrons are and why the Sun is emitting them.
Okay, so the electrons are the small bits of atoms. They're the negatively charged bits of atoms. The Sun is so hot, especially the corona is millions of degrees, that the atoms are stripped apart into their constituent ions and electrons. So you take a hydrogen atom and you pull it apart into a proton and electron. You take some helium and you pull it apart into a helium nucleus and some electrons. So all these electrons have been separated from their hydrogen and helium atoms, and they're streaming around with lots of energy. And since they're light and they're fast, they try and just stream away from the sun. But that sets up an imbalance where you've taken away some negative charge and you've left some positive charge behind. And what that does is it sets up an electric field to try and pull things back together. And so if you're clever and you can read what these electrons are telling you, you can actually back out what that electric field is.
Mm-hmm. And so these electrons racing out from the sun, the stream of them closer to the sun is very different than the stream that is hitting the Earth and the Earth's atmosphere?
That's right. And that's just a function of how long it takes for them to come out from the sun and towards the Earth and all the things that can happen to them along that journey. In particular, they collide. Just like molecules in a river, to go back to my river analogy, those molecules are always bouncing and colliding off of each other. The solar wind is much more rarefied than a river, but there still are collisions. And so the electrons collide with each other, and that erases that information that we're able to read when we're close to the sun.
Mm-hmm. And so what is the significance of these latest findings?
Well, one thing that it tells us or helps to tell us is what are the important processes that are actually accelerating the solar wind. The solar wind flows out from the sun at about 1,000,000 miles an hour, which is a real number, one of my favorite real numbers. And we don't quite know how it gets going that fast. One of the ideas that's out there is that it's actually this self-same electric field that we're measuring that accelerates the solar wind. And certainly that electric field does provide a bit of a kick to the solar wind. What we're seeing right now, though, is that it is not enough to give it that whole 1,000,000 miles an hour. So there's still a missing piece. The fact that it's probably not all the electric field, though, points us in some other directions as to what is the rest of that acceleration.
Mm-hmm. And why does it matter that we understand where that acceleration comes from entirely?
Well, because that solar wind comes out and it flows past the Earth and it carries electromagnetic fields and energetic particles that interact with our magnetosphere and our atmosphere and also interact with sensitive electrical systems in satellites around the Earth and even power lines and power grids on the ground. So we're sitting here exposed to that solar wind flow, and so we'd like to understand how it's accelerated. And we'd also like to understand, to bring it back to my river analogy, we want to know when that river is going to flood in advance so we can make preparations for it.
Mm. Oh, so it ebbs and flows, so to speak, this solar wind, and we don't know quite why that is?
Yeah, and just as a river that, you know, might be perfectly quiescent and nice to sit by and fish most of the year, but once a year it crests and it floods, you'd like to know when that flood's coming. The solar wind is similar. A lot of the time it's very quiet, pretty steady, but every once in a while there are very energetic events, for instance, coronal mass ejections. And when those hit the Earth, that's when you've got to start watching your power grid and taking care of your sensitive electronics and so forth.
Mm-hmm. How sophisticated are we in predicting those solar winds currently?
Well, we're getting better and better. I mean, there are a lot of smart people working on this and a lot of computing power that has been trained on this problem. You can only do so much with remote observation. So Parker Solar Probe is really giving us this first look right in close. And I think it's going to help kind of fill in the gap between the visible sun that we can see and then the part that we can observe when it gets all the way out to the Earth.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more about the Parker Solar Probe. How big is the entire, not just the instrument, but the entire probe?
Well, so the spacecraft is a couple of meters long, so it's about the size of an SUV. A lot of that is the cooling system. So when we get close to the sun, we get up to over 1,000 degrees just from the full blast of the sunlight that we're getting there. So we have a very fancy heat shield on the front of the spacecraft made out of a carbon-carbon composite, and that heats up to the full temperature. But behind, in the shade of that heat shield, is all the sensitive parts of the spacecraft, some plumbing to radiate heat away. And then all of our instruments are kind of on the very back end of the spacecraft in the shadiest part. And they actually stay quite cool. They stay at room temperature or even a little bit below room temperature. So the solar probe is really an amazing thing.
Wow. That is so this is 2 meters long. The heat shields in the front are experiencing 1,000 degrees, and in just a little ways behind those heat shields, we've got room temperatures.
Yeah, it's really quite an engineering miracle.
So if this probe had, in that shady area, a capsule that could support humans, you or I, in a capsule, what would we see at certain times as this probe makes its orbits around the sun? I mean, the sun is so huge. How much of our window port would be taken up by the sun at certain times? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, well, certainly when we get very close to the sun, we get in right now to about 20 solar radii. By the end of the mission, we'll get to about 10 solar radii. And at that point, the sun will take up a disk that's about 12 degrees on the sky. So, you know, if you hold your fist out at arm's length, the sun's mm-hmm. going to be about that big. It's going to take up a considerable portion of the sky. Needless to say, you shouldn't look at it. It'll burn your retinas.
Right. What is, Jasper, what is the future of this probe and the next questions you're looking to answer?
So right now, we've gone through 8 orbits. We're starting our 9th. By the end of the mission, if everything goes as planned, we will have done over 20 orbits, and we will have gotten a factor of 2 closer than we are now. It takes a long time to do this. As I mentioned, every orbit is 100 days or so, and we have lots of them. So the end of the prime mission won't be until 2025. And we hope that we're going to keep making new discoveries every time we get in a little bit closer to the sun along that journey.
Fabulous. Always fascinating to talk with you. Jasper Halicus, Associate Professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa, lead author of a new study that delivers the first definitive measurements of the sun's electric field and how this electric field interacts with the solar wind. Jasper Halicus, thank you very much. Take care.
Thanks very much, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. For decades, a common view among scientists has been that the first people, first humans, ancestors of Native Americans, came across a land bridge from modern-day Siberia into North America sometime around 13,000 years ago. But now, an unexpected discovery made recently by an Iowa State University researcher suggests that the first humans may have arrived in North America much earlier, more than 30,000 years ago, and that's nearly 20,000 years earlier than originally thought. Andrew Somerville joins us now, Assistant Professor of Anthropology in the Department of World Languages and Cultures at Iowa State University. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hi, hello. Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's start off by having you tell us a little bit more about the common understanding over recent decades of when and how the first humans came to North America.
Sure. For a long time, the traditional idea was that humans first arrived in North America around 13,500 years ago, and that they arrived over the Bering Land Bridge. So they walked across this piece of land that was exposed during the Ice Age from Canada, or from Alaska over to Canada. They passed through an ice-free corridor down into the United States, and from there by foot, they made their way all the way down to South America. But a series of recent discoveries, including possibly our own, is starting to push that timeline back much further.
Okay, let's talk about your discovery specifically. I understand that you were in Mexico, and actually the point of your research was not to find this discovery. So tell us what you were doing down there, when?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, my research is in the Tehuacan Valley in the modern Mexican state of Puebla. And this region called the Tehuacan Valley, it's very famous in archaeology circles. because it's a very rich archaeological area. It's very dry, and there's a series of caves. So organic materials that normally wouldn't preserve very well have lasted for thousands and thousands of years in this area. So my team and I, which includes some researchers from the National Autonomous University in Mexico and some researchers that work for the Mexican government, and I were actually studying the origins of corn agriculture in this region. So we actually went back to some collections from excavations that happened in the 1960s, and we were trying to study the chemicals and animal bones to reconstruct how the environment had changed over time. And we wanted to kind of relate those possible environmental changes to when people first started farming. Maybe there was a connection between the two. And as part of that project, we sent out some animal bones for radiocarbon dating. And we weren't expecting anything too exciting. We were expecting everything to be 10,000 years old or younger. So when the samples, when the dates came back from the samples at the bottom levels of this cave that we were studying, they had dates of around 30,000 years old, which was very surprising to us.
Mm-hmm. And this dating method is absolutely reliable.
Yeah, it's radiocarbon dating. It's a very well understood technique. It allows us to date samples that go back to about 50,000 years at the oldest. But yeah, it's very reliable. We study the carbon in the bone collagen of these small animals that they found in the cave. So yeah, we're very confident in the dates.
Okay, so these bones, I understand rabbit and deer bones in this case, were found there. And how do you then tie humans to these bones and the reason that they're in this deep part of this cave?
Exactly. Well, that's the somewhat trickier part, tying humans to this time period, to this level of the cave. The original excavators of the cave, which I mentioned was back in the 60s, they had assumed that these earliest levels were human occupations. There appeared to be floor surfaces that people were living on. The animal bones appeared to have been processed or cooked by humans. But since it was excavated about 60 years ago, there are some question marks. So a major focus of ours going forward will be to try to link humans to these animal bones a little more conclusively. So my colleague Matt Hill and I were planning to go back and re-examine the collection, look at the animal bones under a microscope, look for cut marks, look for more obvious signs of human modification, and really try to tie humans to this level more conclusively.
Okay, so if true, if you can confirm it, provide more scientific evidence that these bones were from rabbits and deer killed by early humans, why would that be significant? I mean, this is a huge difference in the timeline, right?
That's right. Well, it'd be significant because it would be such a change in our understanding of how the Americas were first populated. And it also ties into a number of other related questions. If humans were arriving around 30,000 years ago, we have to rethink how they got here. Because around 30,000 years ago, this was the Ice Age. And we have to consider that there were giant glaciers sitting on top of Canada. So there wouldn't have been an overland route for humans to arrive. They would have had to have come down the coasts to get here. So that's one kind of implication. It'll change our understanding. But also, if humans were here 30,000 years ago, we have to rethink our relationship with the megafauna, the extinct animals that were here. One major idea, and it's debated, is that humans caused all of the mammoths and giant sloths, giant beavers, the horses that were here originally. The idea is that humans overhunted them and they went extinct. But if we find out that humans were actually here for 30,000 years, then we kind of have to rethink that idea. I mean, humans would have coexisted with them for tens of thousands of years. So it changes the equation a little.
Mm. And you said it changes, you know, perhaps how people got here, but who they were as well. We think they were the Asians from Siberia coming over. Is there now a possibility that they were from some other part of the world?
Well, all genetic analyses of ancient human remains that we've found so far do indicate that these original populations were coming from Northeast Asia, so this region of Siberia today. We don't know who these earliest migrants would have been, but they probably would have been from Siberia also. But it does raise the possibility that there were more than one wave of migrations. And perhaps this represented a very early migration that possibly died out, or the population levels were very much reduced. Because right after this period of around 30,000 years ago, the Ice Age reached its peak, a period called the Last Glacial Maximum. So one idea is that maybe this early population didn't make it through the Ice Age, and then later populations came in and replaced them. But as of now, the main thinking is that all of these populations would have been coming from Siberia originally.
Mm-hmm. And in our few final seconds, what's been the reaction in the scientific community to your discovery?
Overall, it's been fairly supportive, though I will note this is a very controversial issue. But fortunately, there was another paper that was published just last year also that's also suggesting that they have an occupation around 30,000 years ago in Mexico as well. So I think that maybe softened the impact a little bit. But overall, it's been supportive. I've had some great conversations with people over the last month or so.
Andrew Somerville is with Iowa State University, assistant professor of anthropology, talking about an unexpected discovery he and colleagues made that suggests the first humans may have arrived in North America much earlier than we traditionally think. The results recently published in the academic journal Latin American Antiquity. Andrew, fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
What a fascinating debate over when humans first came to North America. When we come back, after a short break, we'll meet some modern-day nomads, you might say. We'll meet an Iowa family of five that has spent the past few months dramatically transforming an old school bus into a home on wheels. And now they plan to spend the next 2 years traveling around North America. We'll meet them and find out more about their almost magical bus after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Thank you, Java, for getting me here. You'll be an inspector, have no fear.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.
We raised the roof in three different sections. We've fabricated and installed a floor raise that is also our water tanks made out of fiberglass and plywood. We're putting in radiant heating for the floor. We've also got a wood pellet stove going in. We've added our own doors. We've added balconies that are also bike racks that extend off the back. Two of our boys get to use the emergency exits as their own private doors, and those will have their own balconies. We haven't fabricated those yet. And we've put a deck on top as, well, at first it was a justification for the solar, but it's now just mostly the best place in the house is to go up onto that roof deck and have your coffee or cocktail and maintain the solar panels.
Chris, are we still talking about a bus? Because some of those features are not bus-like.
That's correct. That's correct. We are talking about a bus.
This is Chris Tallman. He first started working on a construction site when he was just 14. Now in his 40s, he's run several companies, has degrees in design, is a self-taught carpenter and stonemason. Most recently, he's lived in Iowa City with his wife, Jenny, their three sons, Cactus, Oakley, and Cedar, a cat, and a dog.
I'm not from Iowa, but my family's from Iowa. I'm from everywhere and nowhere, born in the States, but grew up in Canada.
It was about 6 months ago that I first noticed a used full-size Thomas school bus, some 40 feet long, parked in my neighborhood, right in the street. And I saw as the days passed, the school bus began to change dramatically, week by week, until it was completely transformed into what it is today. A fresh coat of white paint with a huge wave along its side. And now it looks much more like a rock band's luxury coach bus than an old school bus. And it has these huge ripples in its roof. I later found out the bus's name is Ripple. This is the Tallman family project, but it's part of a much larger mission.
What is the plan? What are you going to do? What are you launching right now? You're going from the preparation stage, the building stage, remodeling. What's the plan now for the next 2 years?
I'm working on a research project where I'm going to be identifying portions of land that can be purchased through a cooperative model so that it can become a cooperative-owned park system for people that are wanting to car camp across the country or park their RVs on it temporarily or any of that. Right now we have a massive pressure on our national park systems, on our state park systems, and on our county level park systems. They're overrun, and when COVID showed up, that blew the problem out of the water.
What Chris did not mention is that while he's conducting his research, his family will be by his side. The entire family will be moving into the bus to live full time. It's their new home.
Your five members plus the cat, no, plus the cat and the dog.
Correct.
Seven. Will all seven be on board when you get done with this expedition?
No. I imagine that we're going to lose our oldest son. He definitely is interested in getting himself into a craft school. He's really interested in metallurgy and blacksmithing, and this project has really ignited that in him because he's gotten to do so much metalwork. And my arty middle son is very likely to head off to art school the second that he can, which is about 6 months away when he finishes his high school degree. Our family's philosophy of how we're going to live in this is that we're going to stay low, so down in the valleys. We're not looking to climb over mountains and get into the wilderness or anything like that, so we're going to stay down low, and we hope to park for like 2 weeks at a time. First trip is to Ontario to see my ailing folks. They're older, and we'd like to say hi to them again. And then we're going to drop into the American Southwest, Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, a little bit of California for the winter, this coming winter of 2021, 2022. And then we're going to do a slow crawl up the West Coast for the summer. And then we'll drop back down through the central portion of Canada in the U.S. And we're going to winter in 2022, 2023 in Florida. Likely Florida and Alabama, Mississippi, the Gulf Coasts, so, and then we're going to do the East Coast for the following summer.
How did this whole project start? When did it start? Do you remember the day you had the idea to do what you're doing?
I don't remember the day. I remember the moment. It would have been in June of 2019, because in late May, right at the end of May, we were camping with friends up in southern Minnesota. And I went for a trail run, and literally I'd just taken my last stride and was going into just a walking cool down, and my friend's dog cut in front of me, and I stepped off the trail but turned my ankle and did a third degree, three tendons torn sprain of my ankle. And so I was flat on a couch for about 4 weeks and then hobbling for another six. And during those first 4 weeks, I spent the first week teaching myself how to do physical therapy so I could walk again. And then the rest of the time was like, what am I doing? What am I doing right now?
It became a big life question.
It became a big life question, which I tend to do the moment I get to pause, because I tend to be frenetic and just do and make. And then when I'm done, I'm kind of like left with a lot of time to think about what I just did and what happens next. I wanted to be building, and I wanted to be building without other people getting in the way. And my experience as a builder, a self-taught carpenter and timber framer and stonemason, was that anytime I wanted to do something that wasn't in the book already, I had to run and find an architect or an engineer. And it turns out, no matter what you do, you still have to run and find an architect or an engineer. And that space of being injured and really not being totally happy with the work I was doing made me look for something I could build without permission.
So far in this pre-launch phase, what have been the biggest challenges, perhaps unexpected hurdles?
It wasn't unexpected. I knew that building something on the street was going to be difficult. That's been our, between the weather, which is always a builder's problem, it's the not being able to have it just parked in front of the house, having to walk across the street with a sheet of plywood, and then you have to take it back to do another cut. That's gotten tiresome. That's gotten old. That's our biggest hurdle.
We have a wonderful breeze on a very hot day. We've been talking for a few minutes. Can I ask us to cross the street and you introduce us to, and this has a name, the bus has a name, right?
The bus is Ripple. The height of the school bus at the front is 8'9", and the height at the rear with the solar panels is 12'8.5".
Okay. Will you take us inside?
So this is entering through the cab.
So we're going right up the stairs. Okay. We're standing right at the front, right behind the driver's seat here, and you've got a couple of nice benches here. I see they open up for storage. Pretty much everything has to open up for storage. You can't have any wasted space here, can you?
Yeah, we can't. With five basically adults moving in, we need every little pocket of space we can. So we've just entered underneath the first roof raise, and we're standing in the bathroom kitchen section. The four of us are in the kitchen area, and you can see a slight arc to this elevated platform of plywood, and that is our gray water tank. So that's where soapy dishwater and stuff goes, and shower water. And this platform is actually the shape and size of the bathroom. So the bathroom will have that round tub I talked about there. It also has a misting shower. And then composting toilet actually sits over that open hole right there. That will go down into the underbay storage, which is something this bus has. It has a huge through underbay storage, two big doors. You see them a lot on the commercial buses that are moving around. So you're standing in the hallway that will then lead between the kids' bedroom pods. And the way that the pods work are that one's on top and one's below. And so I'm standing in front of Cedar's door, which is also in front of the driver's side emergency exit. And so Cedar can step up into his room, and he'll have approximately 8 square feet of floor space where he can stand, and he'll have a fold-down desk and all that sort of thing.
So each of the five of you has a private space.
Oh yes, that was our middleist's requirement, was that if he didn't have soundproof walls and his own private bedroom, he wasn't going to get on a bus.
Well, that also preserves sanity, doesn't it, for all of you, doesn't it? It makes sense, right?
Yeah, no, it makes tons of sense. And I think it's one of the reasons why people find RV living or converting any sort of vehicle into a home difficult to wrap their heads around, because they're going to be entering into a world where not just the comforts of extra space and the ability to consume are taken away from you, but some of those qualities that are really vital to a complex modern experience of the world, where you're taking in lots of information. Well, you need some places to decompress and process that information, and sometimes you need solitude to do that. And sometimes it's raining for 4 days in a row and you got to be inside. But this is where the dining table will be. This is the lower roof, right? This is the lower part that we didn't raise the roof on.
The lowest part has a skylight here. You can pop out of the hatch here.
Yep. It's got a roof hatch.
Well, at this point, we've crawled through a hatch in the top of the the bus in the top of Ripple here. There's a stepladder here. There's going to be a proper stairway there a little bit later, but I'm standing on one of three platforms, the foremost front platform with Chris here. These will be balconies, as Chris explains. And then the back platform is the largest of the three, and it has solar panels, huge solar panels on it. And also, if there are any grizzlies, it's a good idea.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You've had how many discussions with your kids, with your wife? What is their point of success? What are they getting out of it as far as you understand?
My wife is already over the moon. She took some pretty hard convincing very early on, just about the veracity of the idea and whether or not I was checking enough of the boxes for basic life needs. Once she started to see the design documents and understand that I could actually build this, she became the biggest proponent of it. She's the financier of this project. She earns the dollars that go into the bus right now. She gave me the time off, ostensibly to spend with the kids. And I needed something to show the kids what I know, I guess, because what else does a parent do that's given the chance to be at home with your kids all day long? So for her, she's already arrived. She keeps telling me, don't rush it. Make sure that you do it the way that you know you can do it. Because she just wants this. She wants a home that she owns free and clear. She wants to have a month where what she earns doesn't go to a mortgage company or to a landlord or to a utility company. So that, I mean, she comes from pretty deep poverty, so I can understand that emotional strain that she has.
Your kids are all homeschooled. You and your wife, Jenny, have homeschooled your kids from a young age. They've never been to a public school or a school.
Correct. The first time anybody stepped into a school was when Cactus voted in the primaries here in Iowa. That was the first time he had ever stepped into a high school.
Into a regular school building.
Yeah. Okay. For Cactus, my oldest, it's every day. It's every day that he gets to do hard labor. He's had a very hard time being born into the computer age. As good as he is with electrical engineering and computers, one of his first real passions and interests.
I'm Cactus Tallman. I'm 19.
There aren't going to be as many occupants in the bus as when it started out. Are you one of those being left off?
I'm one of those being left off. I'm going to jettison myself as soon as I find a nice place.
Do you know where that'll be?
I don't know. I don't know. Nice places pop up all over the place.
Wow, and you're comfortable with that idea.
I'm totally comfortable with that. Yeah.
People would be so frightened of that uncertainty. How can you deal with it?
I don't know. I don't know. I haven't had all that much certainty in my life so far. I haven't always had money. Haven't always had a clear plan of what's happening next. I mean, moving to Iowa was uncertainty. That was being up in northern Manitoba during the winter after moving up there from Minnesota, and then we were up there for 4 months in the freezing cold, freezing our asses off. Sorry, I probably can't say that on radio. Yeah. Then contract just goes south, and we end up moving down to Iowa City because my aunt lives here. So we stayed in her basement for like a month and a half, and then eventually we found a place to live. That was on Maggard Street, owned by Big Ten, so that's a whole deal. Ugh. And eventually we move here. And we've been here for 2.5, 3 years, I think. Yeah. Not good with time anymore.
In this time that you've been working on this project, can you tell me the ways in which it's changed you?
Oh yeah, definitely. I used to be convinced that I was going to go into computer engineering, computer software, that sort of stuff. I've turned 180 degrees on that now. I'm just doing a little bit of metalwork on this bus. I'm excited to get into metalworking. That's what I'm looking for on the bus, a place to really dig my teeth into that.
For Oakley, he was the most reticent and resistant to getting on the bus. He's our middle son.
I'm Oakley Tallman. I'm 17 years old.
Is there a location that you're most excited about stopping at?
For an odd reason, yes. Nevada, because like most of my friends live there and I've been wanting to meet them for years now. So
Like, you have friends you've never met?
Most of my friends are online. I've made them through video games and just meeting them through other friends from video games. So I don't actually have any friends, like, locally in Iowa. I've pretty much only had friends online since being in Iowa, but, yeah.
Wow.
It's been nice to meet all of them for years now, to be honest.
That is remarkable. You have, and these are not just what we call Facebook friends, which are, you know, Facebook. These are friends, you can count them as friends, and you will meet them face-to-face for the first time in the coming months.
Yeah, pretty much. It is weird. Like, I've known... Like, the one I've known for the longest time is 3 years now, and she's been my best friend for, like, most of that time, and I've, like, never met her face-to-face, which is interesting, but, yeah. That's so far been, like, at first, when the project was starting, I felt a bit iffy about it, I guess. Like, I wasn't too sure if I wouldn't like it, I wasn't too sure about the whole idea of it, but then that was, like, the thing which, like, drove me to actually want to do it, is that I would have the opportunity to meet people. And meet my friends and all that kind of stuff.
And then Cedar is just, yeah, he's an enigma. We don't exactly know what's going on with him. He's our hardest worker. He barely gets up after I do. I'm up at 5 every day, and he's always out till the last moment.
My name is Cedar Tolman. I'm 16, and I'd say my main role in the bus, at least my main specific role, is I do all of the sort of recording or photography or anything like that. We'll be starting a YouTube channel in a couple months now. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I do basically all of that, the editing and such. And otherwise, I mostly just basically help out. Like in the past week or two, I've put up like half of the ceiling, and I've done a lot of the walls.
You've had a lot of time in preparing this bus to contemplate how it will be when you're out on the road. What are your biggest concerns being out on the road in the next 2 years? What, a lot of unknowns there you have to deal with, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, it is a really tight space, so I'm sure that, you know, any time we're having little fights or bickers, that's sort of taken to an extreme. But, I mean, really, we'll be using the outside pretty well. Really, most of my worries we've basically gotten out of the way. We always just talk about them. We just solve the problem. So I really barely have any worries.
Do you have a moment that you envision? I mean, you can only imagine you've sort of daydreamed about how these next 2 years will be. Where do you think you'll get your most amount of satisfaction? What will be the point at which you say, did it, I've arrived?
I know this one very well. This was part of the original thought. So I've got a whiteboard picture of my first sketches of what I was doing. I'm a backpacker, and so the first moment I'll know that this was a success is that I'll come out of the woods after a long stretch of time, at least 10 days in the woods, and I'll see the bus in the distance, and I'll feel like I'm going home. That'll be a really good moment. Because right now it's just a bus to me. I mean, it's crazy. It's weird. It's beautiful. It's concerning. I mean, I have to become a diesel mechanic in the next few days sort of thing. But when I get to walk out of something that is my joy in life, which is just traipsing around with my own mind or my kids or friends in the woods, and I get to look and see my home in the distance, that's going to be spectacular.
The more I find out about it, the more interesting it becomes. And the more I know I am going to want to follow this, and I know Iowa Public Radio listeners will want to follow you on your trip. Well, congratulations on this nearly completed first stage. You've accomplished more than people could even dream of already, and there's still the bulk of it to come. So congratulations. Thank you for this conversation.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's been... Well, thank you for being a neighbor, first of all, for being a happy neighbor for us doing this, and for the interest. Like, it's probably my own neuroses that I'm not aware of what it is that we're doing here. I think the kids are, and this neighborhood has allowed me. So I'm seeing what I'm doing through the neighborhood, through the people that I interact with, through the folks that tell me what they see and how it's making them feel. And that's really good. because I'm kind of just a blind astronaut in this whole project, and I don't really know what's going on. I know I'm going to the moon, but I'm not sure that I'm the pilot of this whole thing. It really was meant to be for the kids. It was really meant to be me transferring my knowledge and what I can do when I have a little bit of elbow room to do it in.
There's a lot of fathers out there, a number of fathers out there I know, envious of how you've raised these kids. You've got amazing boys, developing them with so many skills, and just really nice humans. Nice people to be on the planet with.
So. Thank you. Yeah, it's a small planet, so more nice humans and more crazy projects. Let's start moving around, folks.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we'll check in with you, if that's okay, down the road. Metaphorically, figuratively, and literally down the road.
Absolutely. We'll see you in October for sure. And I've got all the reasons in the world to come back here again and again. So we're going to bump into you again.
And this little radio adventure wouldn't be complete without letting you see this amazing bus. Photos of Chris, his sons, Cactus, Cedar, and Oakley, and of course, Ripple Bus can be found at iowapublicradio.org. That's also where you can find out how to follow their journey via their social media.
Support for IPR comes from the Healing Room at Upstream Functional Medicine, offering medical spa services that support the body's natural ability to detoxify from environmental challenges. Learn more about the Healing Room at upstreamfm.com.
Today's River to River was produced by Rick Brewer with help from Zachary Oren Smith. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.